Thank you, George. Well, I think there's nothing like a talk on Latin America and Africa to cheer you up. Ultimately, this book, though, is not just about failed development stories. In fact, more than half of it's dedicated to success stories, and ultimately that's what we're interested in, is taking less developed regions of the world and helping them to transform. So one of those success stories I'd like to talk with you about tonight is Ireland, just very briefly. Now, of course, compared to sub-Saharan Africa or Latin America, they had a relatively high standard of living already. But compared to the rest of Western Europe, they were far behind, about two-thirds of the level of Western Europe or Great Britain's standard of living for most of the last 60 years. But then something started to change in the mid-1980s. First, 1986 to 90, they start to improve growth rates a little bit, and then later on in the late half of the 1990s, dramatic growth, 10% per year or so, almost 10% per year. In a period of under 15 years, they went from two-thirds the standard of living to actually wealthier than the European average, and wealthier than Great Britain. How to explain this? When I first started looking at it, the dominant explanation people were using was EU subsidies, EU structural fund subsidies, essentially a form of foreign aid from wealthy European nations to less wealthy European nations. And it struck me as a rather odd explanation, because it has a lot of the problems, albeit with less corruption probably, than aid to Africa programs. It's still a form of aid for infrastructure, aid for education. And like it, it faces the same type of calculational issues of how to best use it, because it's outside of the profit and loss system that usually directs investment. It also distorts entrepreneurial incentives. Basically, in Ireland's case, by creating a pot of gold for Irish entrepreneurs to go after. They spend their time and effort trying to get the transfers of the structural funds instead of better serving consumers. When we actually look at it empirically, it doesn't hold up very well either. First of all, Spain, Greece, Portugal all had about the same type of transfers from the European Union during the same period of time and didn't get the big growth. And when we look at Ireland, they had been getting the structural fund subsidy since the early 1970s when they weren't growing and they didn't help then. And in fact, as a percent of their economy, it got less and less important as the growth kept going. So it doesn't seem to be a very good explanation. The real story is much more consistent with the theme of this book, and that's creating the enabling environment that really unleashed the entrepreneurs, basically enhancing economic freedom in the country. They always had relatively good rule of law, respect for private property rights. In the 1960s, they had improved their international trade policy, first with Anglo-Irish free trade agreements, but then with unilateral tariff reductions against the rest of the world. The 1970s, not so happy. Basically, in response to the oil shocks, they engaged in a lot of the same style Keynesian stimulus packages that we in the United States and in Western Europe were doing, and if you listen to people in Washington, D.C. today, are still thinking about doing. The result was not that great growth, but since everybody else in the world was doing it as well, Ireland didn't really fall that much farther behind. They remained about two-thirds the standard of living. But in doing this, in all their spending, they tried raising taxes to cover some of it. But they couldn't raise taxes enough and started facing diminishing revenue. Their borrowing started increasing, got up to about 17% of GNP a year. By 1986, they had got themselves in a position where they had 116% debt-to-GDP ratio. The government owed more than the value of everything that was produced in the economy in a single year. They got to this situation, and there was no big ideological shift. They were basically facing a financial crisis and worrying about an IMF intervention to bail them out. The prime minister who was elected actually ran against making any changes. In fact, he was one of the guys whose big spending policies got them into this situation to start with. But once in office, it was deemed that they didn't want to inflate to try to get rid of the debt. They had already tried higher taxes. That wasn't working. They were already up to the limits of what they could borrow. They were really faced with only one alternative, or two alternatives, really, either outside intervention or cut spending. They chose to cut spending. And in a dramatic fashion over the course of 5 years, really started transforming the role of the Irish government in the economy. They went from a situation in 1985 where the government consumed 55% of everything produced in the economy. By 1990, after the spending cuts, it was down to 41% of the economy. 14% reduction in a period of 5 years, in a period of 5 years where it's really not the economy that just outgrew the rate of government spending growth. They actually made real cuts in government spending. In both 1987, they slashed government spending so they got rid of their primary deficit. Then they followed up with even bigger cuts in 1988. So they made true cuts, not cuts like they talk about in Washington, D.C., like a cut in the rate of growth of spending, but actual cuts where you spend less the next year than you did the prior year, what most of us in our own household accounts would call cuts in spending. This kind of got them out of the financial crisis. By 1990, they were back under 100% debt-to-GDP ratio. Growth rates were starting to improve. But an interesting thing happened here to kind of social partnership formed in Ireland that kept pushing for further reforms. There was one other outside influence, and while I think myself and probably others here have a lot of reservations about the European Union, the Maastricht Treaty did do a couple things for Ireland. One, it made the government's promises to continue to reduce debt more credible, because it set a target debt to GDP ratio by 1999 of 60% debt to GDP. So as a signal, if Ireland wanted to become part of the European Union, they were going to have to continue to make reductions in this. It also said that they couldn't have budget deficits more than 3% of GDP. So it was a signal that they were going to continue being more fiscally responsible if they wanted to get this. So it's not perfectly credible, but it's at least partially credible. Also, with the nearing of the date for the euro, even though they had this system of fixed exchange rates with the European currencies before this, it started to become a bigger deal if you had to do a devaluation. That meant inflation was going to remain in check. So with inflation cut off and debt issue cut off as ways to expand the Irish government spending, the last option is higher taxation. And that's what actually the social partnership pushed up against. It was a mixing together of business interests and labor interests lobbying the government. And usually when we hear of this, we think of corporatism, maybe in the style of Latin America. But here it actually became a force lobbying for free markets. The labor unions basically said to business, we will have smaller wage increases that we want from you if we can get our real wages to increase even faster by keeping the government's rate of inflation low and then lowering the tax burden. So what we had was multiple cuts in the tax rate. It started off, the top marginal tax rate was 65% before the reform period started in 1985. They had multiple rounds of these reductions. By 2001, the top rate was down to 44%. The standard rate, they have a two-tier rate there, was down to 22%. One area of taxation remained a little bit higher, and that was corporate taxes. They were still at a rate of 40% corporate tax rate in 1996. This eventually got cut to 24%. But they also had that special 10% corporate tax rate. And this is what really angered a lot of people in the OECD. In fact, they started calling it harmful tax competition, which my interpretation means unless you have taxes as high as France, it's not fair. But what this 10% rate applied to was companies that located in the Shannon or Dublin duty-free zones, and also companies engaged in internationally traded financial services or technology. And they kept coming under pressure from when the OECD ran this campaign against harmful tax competition. In fact, even the United States was recognized as a tax haven during this campaign, if that gives you an idea of what they were thinking. Ireland, though, their response, I think, is just phenomenal. They gave in. But their way of giving in was saying, okay, we'll get rid of the special 10% rate. We'll give 12.5% to everybody. So they got rid of that small rate, but then they cut corporate taxes in half for everybody else. And in the process, by the way, got rid of the distortionary effect that just having a special rate for some companies creates in terms of bias, in terms of industry or location. So big progress. By the end of the decade, by 1999, tax burden as a percent of GDP in Ireland is 31%. 15-year period, you go from 55% of the economy being consumed by the government to 31%. Big change. No big ideological shift here. There's no comparable Thatcher revolution or Reagan revolution going on in Ireland. But yet, in Ireland, they actually made much more progress in the way of shrinking government relative to the economy than we did in the United States or than Great Britain did. Really, it was in response to this crisis that they faced. They had to do something. Once they got out of the crisis, it seems to be the positive feedback of getting the growth that kept the people interested in making the reforms. Interesting, the reforms have stalled more recently. Really, since 2000, they've been backsliding a little bit. If you look at their index of economic freedom score, they don't do as well now as they used to, although they're still one of the freest countries in the world, and they continue to grow, but not nearly like the 10% rate that they were doing in the last half of the 1990s. In part, maybe, the positive feedback slowed down when the U.S. had its recession in 2001. That translated into Ireland as well because there's such a big trade relationship between the two. And then there was no further push for the reform, and they've slid back a little bit. Ireland, while an important success story, is certainly not the only one we study in this book. We look at China, India, Botswana, New Zealand, also as success stories. The theme of crisis comes up a few times. Paul Scher and Renuk Sen in the chapter on India and Frederick Sauté on New Zealand both write of the crucial role that financial crisis played there in promoting reform. In fact, in a perverse way, kind of, maybe the best way that the IMF promotes reform in other parts of the world is by being so bad at their interventions that countries are scared into making their own reforms so they don't have to deal with them. Because that's basically
part of the cause of the reform in all three of these places. Of course, China is a tremendous story that James Dorn tells in his chapter. In terms of improvement of economic freedom, it's made the biggest increases in all of Asia since 1980. Illustrates a couple important points with the big growth that's occurring there. China is not an exception to the story being told in this book. In fact, it's a good illustration of it. While they're still not nearly as free economically as they could be, and as a lot of the developed nations of the West are, they've made a lot of progress moving in that direction. It tells you not only does your level of freedom matter, but just making improvements in the environment can really unleash pent-up growth that is there. Also highlights the difference between political and economic freedom. What's necessary for prosperity and promoting progress is economic freedom, not political freedom. Often attempts to export democracy are focusing on the wrong thing. What's really needed is the economic freedoms. And what we find quite often is, as you get greater economic freedoms and you grow, people tend to demand more democratic and civil freedoms. It will be interesting to see how that plays out in China. Also, what Dorn does very well in the chapter, if you look at reports that you'll see in the news now often, growing inequality in China, and they'll talk about it being related to the economic growth there. Well, of course it is. Everybody was poor. Now some are becoming better off. This is actually something to celebrate, not to get upset about. What he does is actually look in different regions of China, because a lot of the reform has been at the local level there, not the national level. So there's big differences in how much people have opened up to markets in different areas of the country. So he uses a marketization index, actually, to look at the different regions and how much they've moved that way, and finds that the more they've moved towards the market, the greater the prosperity in a region. So a lot of the inequality that's being reported in China actually comes from the disparities between the regions, those who have opened up and are more free, and those who have it. So the answer isn't some sort of redistributionist scheme in China. It's, yeah, redistribute freedom to the rest of the country as well. And even Africa isn't just a sad story. There's success stories there as well, the biggest one being Botswana, and that's what Scott Bulliard deals with in his chapter. In fact, some people would be surprised to know the fastest growing country in the world from the mid-1960s to the mid-1990s is Botswana, a semi-arid, landlocked British protectorate in sub-Saharan Africa, just north of South Africa. Later on, diamonds were discovered there, so they were no exception to the rule of resources being in Africa. But they didn't know they had the diamonds when they started this big growth path. In fact, as Bulliard argues in his chapter, he thinks the diamonds are actually slowing the growth now. How they did it was they took a traditional indigenous leader who came to power. They didn't displace local property rights and customs, but they did embrace rule of law, basic economic freedoms, respect for private property rights in the country, and instead of fighting over resources that already exist there, they created the right environment for entrepreneurs to create new resources and to create growth, and that's how they were the great growth machine for 30 years. Later, since they've discovered diamonds, what was a very limited government has increasingly grown, although it's still quite good by African standards, kind of tallest dwarf syndrome, I guess. But there, Bulliard argues that the revenues that the government's getting from the diamonds are bloating that, and as that dries up, there's going to be bigger problems for the rest of the economy. So it's not a book about failure stories. It's a lot about success stories, and then looking at these other regions that haven't developed and saying, well, why haven't they? What are the missing institutions there to get them to harness this type of entrepreneurship? So a few lessons come from this. One, I think the first rule in terms of, quote, making poor nations rich from our perspective in the West should be, first rule should be do no harm. I think, one, the role of crisis can play a valuable role by breaking basically existing political deadlocks that have existing inefficient regimes in power. It doesn't guarantee you beneficial reform. There's certainly no shortage of crises in Africa, but it at least gives you a shot at it by breaking the stalemate. Often, our foreign aid programs lock in inefficient regimes by basically transferring money to them that enhances the political sphere at the expense of the economics or the private voluntary sphere, much as P.T. Bauer long contended. Other rule, we have to be pretty modest about what we can do when it comes to, quote, making a poor nation rich. Ultimately, they have to get the right institutions in their own country, and it has to be supported by the local indigenous base. If it's not, they're not going to stick. You can't do this at gunpoint. How do you do it? Ultimately, it's about trade and ideas. There's some evidence that as you trade more with the country, when a more free country trades with a less free country, the one who has less freedom tends to improve over time. So one thing we could do that would, one, be good for African or other poor regions of the world development right now is open up our markets to them more and trade more freely with them. But it also might be good in the long term in terms of generating the trade and ideas that can help get you beneficial institutional change. And the big thing is talking about it and exporting these type of ideas instead of often what we look at as policymakers in the West is not our fundamental institutions that grew us rich, but really our more interventionist institutions that we've grafted on top of that. And then what we end up exporting is our governmental apparatus instead of our underlying fundamental institutions that generated the prosperity that allow us to afford our bloated governments. But to end on a good note or a happy note, but seriously, the upshot is huge. Think of the process in Britain and the United States. 250-year process of going from essentially sub-Saharan African living standards, maybe a little bit better, to a wealthy first world nation. All the capital, all the knowledge had to be created. Then think back to the Asian tigers. Remember when made in Hong Kong, made in Taiwan was a joke? It's not anymore. In a period of three generations, they went from third world status to first world status. In the 1950s, South Korea essentially had the standard of living of sub-Saharan Africa. Few generations, first world status. Now look at China and India. The growth there is even more dramatic as they're making improvements. So the upshot for Africa, for Latin America, for other regions of the world is when you do get the institutions right, there's so much more knowledge out there now, so much more capital out there now that will flow to you, the process can happen a lot quicker. It's still a process. There's no silver bullet. We can't just export something to you that makes it happen. But you get your institutions right, the capital, the ideas, they'll flow to you, so will the trade, and you can grow a lot faster now than you used to. Thank you.